Hello and welcome to the third episode of your First Post Cricket Podcast. I am your host Vaibhav Shah and I'm joined by two veteran journalists, Ayaz Memon and Gaurav Kalra.
One more veteran than the other.
You had to say that, Gaurav.
Today's topic is coinciding with your eras of journalism as well. And speaking of eras, our love for cricket is defined by teams which entertained and dominated cricket, and it revolved around it. The 80s especially was West Indies' era, and I believe that was your formative years of journalism, Ayaz.
Yeah.
And Australia, which was the second era, since started in the late 90s and ran up to 2007-8, which coincided with yours. Now, the big question is, are we on the brink of a third one? Is there a possibility, with the way Indian team has been performing, it's going to take charge of the next decade and dominate the cricketing world? I would want you to hold your answers till the end of it. Let's build towards it. We haven't seen Bradman's Invincibles, but Ayaz, you have seen, covered, dissected, ruminated, even celebrated, for that matter, West Indies' golden age. What was it like?
The West Indies, obviously, you know, in modern cricket or post-war cricket, was perhaps the most destructive team that I've seen. I would still venture that they would beat any of the other teams that you mentioned. John Bradman's Invincibles, none of us have seen in that sense. The West Indies, through the late 70s and right through the 80s, they were all conquering. They didn't lose playing away from home. And they had an assembly of players who could excel in all conditions, all situations. Now, they played at a certain pace which was gave other teams very little chance. Now, that pace was acquired by other teams subsequently. In fact, Australia took it a notch further when they became the dominant team. But even to remember, the interesting part is, even to dismantle the hegemony of the West Indies took about 4 or 5 years for the Australians to do it. And that despite the West Indies gradually losing players of the caliber of Greenidge and Richards and, you know, Holding and Roberts, despite all of that, it didn't just kind of dissemble suddenly. So it shows that when you have a certain quality of players in fairly large numbers, there is a lot of things that you can achieve in different situations by maintaining a momentum which doesn't allow the other team to get in. Now, that is the hallmark of every great team. When the West Indies came and became the powerful force that they were, it wasn't until 1976 when they beat England in England. And that's when Viv Richards became the greatest batsman, and Roberts and Holding and all these, the four great fast bowlers came into being, that they were recognized as a great team. Because remember, just a year earlier, they had got lost badly to Australia, 5-1, playing in Australia. Gaurav will highlight from his memories of the Australian team. Sometimes you need a trigger, you need a catalyzer. For the West Indies, having won the World Cup, went down under, played in Australia, and they got rogered 5-1. And then something happened, some realization in Lloyd, in some of the administrators or people who were the selectors there. There's something that we have not been able to do right. And they reformed, regrouped, redid their strategy, tactics, partly contributed over there by India too, because Indian spinners played havoc with them and they tried to counter India's spinners with their own spinners in a way. In the 75-76 series, it bombed. So they went for that all-pace attack. It worked for them. But what I'm trying to say is that there are defining characteristics that emerge, and the contours of it may change. You know what? You need great batsmen, you need great bowlers, you need a terrific captain, without which you may not be able to win as successfully or as consistently.
Yeah, you're right. 16 undefeated test series is by no means a mean achievement. And West Indies did that throughout the 80s. Early in the 80s, they lost to New Zealand, and they went on winning everywhere across the world. They did so in India as well when they toured in the post the 1983 World Cup, when Malcolm Marshall went through Indian batting lineup. I wanted to understand through you, what was it like? The way they played was never seen before, and probably we haven't seen then.
You know, Vaibhav, I've had many discussions and arguments and kind of disagreements with fellow writers and some cricketers also. I personally feel that the first West Indies team that I saw in 1966 as a 10-year-old boy,
with the Sobers at
with Sobers as captain, he played in India, right, was a far better team than Lloyd's team, in my opinion. Hall, Griffith, Sobers, then there was a off-spinner, Lance Gibbs, there was David Holford, the leg spinner, there was Robin Bynoe and Conrad Hunt, there was Butcher, there was Nurse, and there was, at that point in time, my favourite, Rohan Kanai. Now, that kind of a batting lineup, yes, you know, you can say there was no Wave Richards, but they never won as consistently. The point I'm trying to make is that with all the abundant talent they had, that was not the greatest West Indies team in terms of results. Clive Lloyd's team was. Now, what is it that makes the difference? Why did Lloyd's team become the juggernaut? Things changed externally in the world, perhaps. But I think the West Indies made things change through the 80s. They forced people to become defensive. When they came to India, pitches were specially prepared, absolute pata. Don't give them anything. Because we know what these fast bowlers can do, and they will still beat you because they were so quick in the air, those fast bowlers. So one is that you must enjoy success. You must make winning a habit. You must build up that momentum. Unrelenting. You mentioned about losing in New Zealand. It was one of the most hostile, conflicting series played. I don't know if you've seen a remarkable picture, Gaurav, of Michael Holding, of all the people, kicking a stump out of the ground. And Colin Croft running in, barging, not bowling the delivery, but barging into the umpire. Because they thought that the umpire was not allowing them to win and their record would get marred. So that was the kind of intensity that they had brought to the field of play.
Gaurav, you've been pretty quiet so far. What were your earlier memories of seeing West Indies or hearing on the radio, I believe?
No, I saw a fair bit of the West Indies in the 80s. Yeah. We started getting live telecast of the West Indies playing in different parts of the world as well, and when they came to India as well. I think that the defining aspect of all of this was the quality of the fast bowling. You know, while Viv Richards and Gordon Greenidge were great batsmen, there's no question that they were in their own way intimidating and the kind of players that bowling attacks didn't want to come up against. It was the fact that the fast bowling did not give you respite. And I think that's the defining quality of a world-class test team, that every time a batsman is up against a bowler, he cannot see him off so that a slightly less pedigreed bowler comes into being. Any of those four guys could have taken the new ball. They would have a competition among themselves about who would be the one responsible for the decimation of the innings. So if you had Roberts, Holding, Marshall and Garner as your four-man pace attack, then, you know, you as a batsman, there was no restriction on bouncers. So you would not then be able to play 50% of the deliveries. Where are you scoring runs from? At the end of the day, cricket is about scoring runs and trying to set up test matches in that way. Four bowlers, and on the back of that, Vaibhav, I think the most important thing from that in that era of the West Indies was the guys who were sitting out were equally good. Not slightly inferior or anything of that kind, equally good. And had they made it into test teams, which whenever they did, guys like Patrick Patterson, Kenny Benjamin, Winston Benjamin, Sylvester Clark, Wayne Daniel, players of this kind in that era. So you knew always that against the West Indies, you were up against a team that was going to intimidate you no matter how many runs you got. Whatever you came up against, whichever the circumstances, whichever the conditions, the fact that they were going to be able to take the conditions out of the equation and come at you with these four fast bowlers, I think that was the defining aspect of the West Indies team. Australia was slightly different because Australia were able to bring the Warne factor, which the West Indies did not have.
Before we get into the Australian, you've seen the rise and the fall of eras. So when the baton was passed from Richie Richardson's West Indies to Mark Taylor and Steve Waugh's Australia later on. So tell me about the change which happened.
See, the 95 team, that Australian 95 team that went to the West Indies and won a series in the West Indies, I mean, that is often seen as the tipping point for Australian cricket, to have gone to the West Indies, beaten the West Indies for the first time. I think it was they beat the West Indies in the West Indies, and it was the first time that had happened in a series in the Caribbean for 2 decades. The West Indies hadn't been losing series at home. They had started losing by that time overseas, but they still had Ambrose and Walsh, and there were this famous incident of Steve Waugh and Curtly Ambrose, yes, almost eyeing each other, but the great partnership between the Waugh brothers. And Australia played the same four-man attack for the 4 test matches in that series. They played McGrath, Fleming, Brendan Julian and Shane Warne. So two of those guys are not all-time greats, but it was the fact that Australia were at this point starting to rise as a playing unit. They had some very, very good batsmen, obviously. The Waugh brothers and Steve Waugh and Mark Taylor at the top, players of that kind coming through. But the West Indies at the same time starting to not produce the same quality of personnel. And that was the intersection point from where Australia really took off, and the West Indies continued to be in decline. But, you know, the difference between Australia and the West Indies was the structure. I mean, in the West Indies, the players were being produced in spite of fact that there did not exist a structure. In Australia, the first-class cricket was always extremely competitive. Some international players have often said that playing first-class matches in Australia felt like it was more intense than playing test cricket, especially in the 80s. So, 80s and the 90s.
You're absolutely right. In fact, Imran Khan, current Prime Minister of Pakistan and one time, obviously, great cricketer and captain of Pakistan, he said that he actually became a cricketer in the true sense after playing Packer series in Australia and a couple of Australian tours, because he found that, and he played in Sheffield Shield in Australia. So he says, you know, you realize how tough and how competitive it was when you played in Australia. I think the system should be offering replenishment, you know, on a consistent basis, on a sustained basis. So there will be players, they will retire, some will get injured.
For smooth transition.
For the lag between one generation and the next, you may have a dip, but the dip is not forever, you know, which we are seeing in the case of West Indies now. So, for the West Indies to regroup and recover is going to take long. Now, there are various other reasons for West Indies' decline, but that's not the point. The other thing which I think needs to be highlighted about why these teams become great. Remember, when you talk of Bradman's Invincibles, is you're talking of the 48 series and the Bradman era, maybe about 10 years, 15 years before that, because they dominated. But there were not too many teams playing international cricket. There was England, Australia playing each other more. The West Indies in post 75 right up to 90, they came and kind of established a monopoly of their own. Before that, the teams would win and lose, you know. Australia would, they had a great series, tight test match, but in 68 they went and lost in Australia. Australia would go to the West Indies, they would crib against Charlie Griffiths chucking or Hall and, you know, bouncer barrage unleashed against them, lose there, come back. What I'm saying is that England, Australia, West Indies, these were considered the major teams there. Not so much South Africa, because by then they were already losing their status. New Zealand were the, you know, bichara teams, because not many teams played against them. They didn't have many opportunities. India and Pakistan were major teams coming up. India more than Pakistan, because we had more opportunities. But we didn't somehow figure to be competitors, to compete with them, and especially when playing overseas. One of the things which struck me when I watched the West Indies team is, when you look at these great teams, there are very few changes, the personnel. Over a 10-year period of the West Indies, when you look, when they were a great team, you may have had maybe 30 players who played regularly. You know, so 11, 12, we can count on our fingertips. The changes were marginal.
So the pool was thick.
And the quality was very good. So, something happens, the quality is very good, and the maintenance of that quality. One of the things which I happened to get to know from Viv Richards, I said, yo, guys, you know, this is a really world champion team. I'm talking of 83. Mm-hmm. He says, this man, he pointed at Dennis Whiteman. They used to have a physio.
Dennis Waite, right? Yes.
Dennis Waite. He says, he's the guy who's made us a champion team. Without him, we would not be a champion team. You see, all the fast bowlers, they're not missing a match. And because there was such a fight for places, you know, the competition made them better.
So, you're saying they didn't have problems of workload management and those sort
of things? No, all those problems were there. But the management was effective.
Since then?
See, nobody in those days thought so much of nutrition, sports medicine, sports science in cricket. Exactly. Dennis Waite was an Australian, and Australia was very advanced in sports science even then. So, the West Indies' biggest gain at that point in time was getting this man to come and train them. So, he got these fast bowlers, gung-ho, ready to bowl in Indian conditions, hot and humid and sultry, 10 overs, 8 overs, 6 overs at a stretch, and not, you know, complain the next match that I'm not fit, I'm not playing. In 83, they played a 6 test series. And it's not that the matches were finished in 2.5-3 days. Huh? Last test match at Madras, Gavaskar made 236 not out. You know, it went, it lasted a distance. So, Australians were always very fit and kept fit by the system. The West Indies, apart from their own natural fitness, this was a great addition to their system then. But the quality of play, sometimes it's a matter of luck. It's a matter of chance, happenstance, that you suddenly have all this abundant talent come at the same time.
I would like to know in what ways Australia was similar to the West Indies era and what ways it was different.
I think in terms of natural flair, perhaps the West Indies was the region which produced many more cricketers of great flair. But I think the great success of the Australian system, if you look at the that period in which they dominated, was that, of course, this coming together of players who will perhaps be very strong contenders for an all-time great Australian team will be several players who played on that playing 11. If you look at guys like Matt Hayden, besides the, you know, sort of regular suspects of Vaughan and McGrath, you even have the Ricky Ponting, Steve Waugh, Mark Waugh from that time, Adam Gilchrist, who's perhaps the greatest wicketkeeper batsman to have played. But I think, again, Vaibhav, the great measure of a team of that kind is look at the guys who are sitting out. If you see the current Australian team or the current English team, one of the problems that they had was when a player fell out of form or was injured, the replacement wasn't really a compelling candidate. It was because they had to find someone to fit into that role. But look at the number of players in that time who were averaging 50 plus in domestic cricket for Australia. There were guys like Stuart Law, barely got to play too many test matches, Martin Love, who got to play very little, Greg Blewett, people like that.
Brad Hodge.
Yes, who were all players who were averaging 50 plus in the most competitive first class structure of that time. So there was a real push, a generation of very high quality players coming, and that was the reason why Australia maintained that superiority for a very long period of time over all other teams, because the guys who were coming on the back, Damien Martin, I mean, the guys who were coming on the back of the established players.
Mike Hussey came in so late.
Yeah, I remember watching a series above India where Australia and Australia A were playing in the same one-day series. The Australia versus Australia A matches weren't one-day internationals, but England were involved in that series as well. And Australia A were beating Australia sometimes. The players were so charged up to show it to their seniors that there were several games in which Australia A, or at least I remember instances where Australia A really pushed Australia. So, you know, it's always a measure of a system that you have such high quality players who are pushing the established ones, and that's the reason why they dominated for such a long time.
You rightly pointed out, and we've already discussed regarding some of the ingredients or what goes on into making a dominant force. So it is first class setup, which needs
very robust
first class setup. So we have that for smooth transition, or you, like you mentioned, the lag period should be minimalized. Then you need a spinner is what I believe. I don't know how West Indies managed it without one. Like you said, maybe they were quick through the air, on especially in subcontinental pitches.
Again, it's good luck, you know, to get four such bowlers or six such bowlers at the same time. May not always happen.
Yeah, pacers, batsmen who keep scoring runs. You need a class wicketkeeper, which Australia had. And I believe Geoffrey Dujon was very good with the gloves as well. And obviously, you need a great captain. Lloyd, Waugh, Ponting are considered one of the finest captains that have graced the game. A bit of luck and team management, support staff, everything. Did West Indies and Australia ticked all those boxes?
Well, I think, you know, if you ask an Australian, they'll probably say that these, when you have all these skill sets and the work that they go that goes on behind the scenes put together, then you don't necessarily need your luck. You make your luck yourself. And if you see, you know, one of the things that stands out for me, Vaibhav, is you've got to measure teams also by how they perform on what are really sometimes big occasions. Now, if you see in World Cup finals, for instance, 1999, 2003, 2007, that whole hat-trick of World Cups that came in this golden era of Australian cricket, by the time they reached the final, it was inevitable that they were going to win. And not only did they win those finals, they won those finals by huge margins. 99 destroying Pakistan, who were batting first. 2003 again destroying India when with Ponting and Martin getting those runs. 2007 far too good for Sri Lanka on the day. So that's a measure, you know, by the time you reach the summit clash of a World Cup, you are playing at such a superior level that you just simply have to show up and do your process, and you know you will be better than the others on the park on that day. So that was again a sign of a great team. So I think, you know, perhaps luck is not something that I would The lucky bit of this is that some of their greatest players came together at the same time. That's perhaps something that worked in their favor. But I think their system was so strong that it was just producing these high quality. It was like a conveyor belt, yeah, producing this high quality churn of great players.
But wouldn't you put 99 semifinals to a bit slice of luck?
Sure. I mean, it goes on their record as, there was a little bit of luck involved in that stage. But what the point I'm trying to make is 99, they were struggling for a bit of that World Cup. But from 99 onwards till 2007, then they go on to win 3 World Cups without losing a game.
Talk about you mentioned about captaincy.
Yeah.
And so it might seem so easy when you've got players of the caliber of Viv Richards and the 4 fast bowlers, great fast bowlers, Haynes, Gordon Greenidge, Haynes, etc. So why do you need to captain? But when you've got such magnificent and, you know, great performers, cricketers and sportspersons are like performing artists. They can be very temperamental. They can be highly insecure. So you have to know how to handle them. You have to know how to stoke their ambition. How to stoke their ambition in such a way that they don't collude with each other, but they combine with each other. That is the skill needed for captaincy. There will be, sometimes things that don't pan out the way you imagine or you would want them to. But that's what we find is, and obviously when you have such a bunch of such terrific performers, the captain himself has to be somebody who can command respect, who can earn respect, not demand it for the sake of being captain. You might have a Mike Bradley who's an exception to the, but otherwise you look at any team in the history of the game, you can't have a weak performer performing captain and saying, he's done extremely well, the team has done extremely well because he was there.
Stats are there for everyone to see, and we haven't discussed on it because I don't think the eras are defined by cold numbers. Australia, obviously,
I know where you're headed, so
Australia obviously won everything in their era, besides the 2005 Ashes, and in India in 2001, they won practically everything since 1999 to 2007, which at that point of time, cricket was played much more than it was played in the 80s. So the record now stands with India regarding the home tests, which is 11. And it might go on to 12 and 13. Australia have done it 10 test series wins at home. Twice. And like I said, you cannot measure the teams by stat because cricket was played completely differently. But now it brings us to the first question, which I started this podcast with. Are we on the brink of a cricketing era, or are we jumping the gun? Are we enamored by the fact that India is doing so well? Are there few things still left to be proved? Could you guys weigh in?
The one thing left to be proved is that you have to win more consistently overseas. That's about it, right?
Right.
If you say we've already won 11 times at home, mm-hmm. So that takes winning at home out of the equation or as a factor. What remains? We haven't done well overseas. We won the last series against Australia in Australia. Now, is that the turning point? I'm not going by ranking. But if you talk of a team which is dominant in all situations for a long period of time, not 6 months, then I think that the challenging period comes now. There was a great opportunity last year, which for one reason or the other, we couldn't exploit. I think there are two challenges that confront Virat Kohli and his team. Now, one is the short-term challenge. We are now in the World Test Championship. So, the focus is on that and score enough points to make sure that you are there in the final at least. The other is to leave a long-term legacy as one of the great teams in the history of the game. Now, there is a possibility of doing that, no doubt. And why is there a possibility? Because you seem to have the personnel in place now. You've got what we mentioned earlier, bowlers who can take 20 wickets, batsmen who can consistently deliver you 350 plus runs even overseas. It's a fantastic fielding team compared to what I've seen of Indian teams in the past. So all of these suggest
the wicketkeeper is good enough. Two wicketkeepers.
So, yeah.
And you have a captain who knows how to win.
Correct. And a captain who is very motivated. And so I think these are all great signs,
yeah,
of getting to be in a situation where the West Indies and Australia were, just to kind of.
Yeah, just to narrow this down to the fact that India want to be recognized as a great team, as a great test team. And the measure of that obviously is how well you do at home, but also how well you do away. I mean, one of the great things on Glenn McGrath's CV is something that he's very proud of, is that he was part of a test series win in every country in the world that he played against. I mean, so that is a very, very big plus up tick on his CV. I think the signs are there for this Indian unit, and the next round of overseas series will determine whether this team can be counted or claimed to be counted as among the greatest teams of all time, because there was an opportunity missed in South Africa, like Ayaz mentioned. There were chances in England, but you know, nobody looks back on these situations and says, yeah, sure, there were chances. India's played much better in South Africa than South Africa have played in India, unless India win a series in South Africa. These things will not really be, the scorecard at the end of the day will determine your greatness as, or the score line will determine your greatness as a traveling unit. So I think India has that challenge when its next series of overseas battles begin. They play New Zealand first, immediately after this home circuit. There are two test matches there. The challenges will be South Africa, England and Australia. And all those sides, I think, are sides that India can believe they can overwhelm. Because now, see, Vaibhav, like I mentioned earlier, I think India's not just got the personnel who are by beating South Africa with pace in Indian conditions, they've shown that India is not a one-trick pony team at home. Now, these fast bowlers, without Jasprit Bumrah being part of this team, you add a fourth weapon to this, and the backup fast bowlers. You will look at guys like Navdeep Saini, players of this kind who are on the fringes of the Indian selection. Look at the spin options available. Look at the batsmen who are pushing for spots into the playing, which shows that the system is creating players who are good enough to come in and immediately make an impact. Umesh Yadav comes in, immediately makes an impact. Hanuma Vihari comes in and seizes his opportunity in the West Indies. So I think all of these factors coming together give Indian cricket the hope that they can build a unit that can take its place in history or be spoken of in the same breath at some stage as among Australia and West Indies. But there's no doubt, there's no question they're not there yet. You cannot say that simply because the records show that India haven't won a test series in England and they haven't won a test series in South Africa in the recent past.
I completely agree with Gaurav. If you look at the bunch of players we've got in our 15-member squad now, in fact, the last match which we won at Pune, 9 of the 11 players are in their 30s, all in their early 30s. But not anybody is beyond, over the hill, so to speak. They are, in fact, at their peak or approaching their peak. The remaining 4 are in their 20s. So this bunch, I think, can continue for the next 3, 4, 5 years. And more interestingly and importantly is that there's a whole next bunch which we can identify of maybe 18, 20 players who are also fantastic. So if there is a rollover and new talent comes in, I don't think there'll be a paucity of talent. So India can enjoy a really good run. But
and at a time, Ayaz, sorry if I'm interrupting, but at a time when everywhere around the world you're seeing a slightly decline in standards.
Correct.
I mean, Australia is definitely not as great a team as it used to be. England has major problems with its batting. Everyone seems to be playing with flawed units. India is the least flawed. In fact, I think the most well-resourced and also a team that can also count on having the best support system that it can ask for, given the resources Indian cricket has. So I think all of this is creating what you may call the perfect storm. And over the next 10 years, you may see Indian cricket really create distance between itself and the rest of the world.
So let's end this for Vaibhav. You know, when these dominant great teams come into existence or come around, everybody else starts looking mediocre, incomplete.
Yeah, so exactly I wanted to ask. Did that happen when, you know, West Indies was
everybody,
sort of...
Against the West Indies, everybody looked inadequate. Nobody had those kind of fast bowlers, for instance. When you talked of the Australians, nobody had a fast bowler like a Magrath or a spinner like
one. So there were signs of our domination.
No, I'm saying, so there are obviously these qualities which are, you know, which define these great teams.
In fact, the only team that really competed against the great Australians was India.
That
was the only team that even in when they travelled to Australia a couple of times, they played quite well. 1999-2000, they were beaten very badly. But on the next tour, 2003-2004 and 2007-2008, when the controversial tour, both of those tours, India played quite well. 1998, India played very well against Australia, beat them in India. 2001, beat them again. 2004, Australia came here and beat India, but that was a competitive series as well. So I think, you know, that phase, India was the only team that was consistently pushing the Australians, but the Australians were so good that they would still come through this these examinations.
So certainly not in the same breath as of now, but
definitely
at the
not.
Foothill.
Yes.
Definitely yes. not. Showing signs
yeah.
of building a legacy that we maybe after 7-8 years can say, yeah, right, this was one of the great teams of modern day cricket. The next set, I think, Vaibhav, the most important thing is the next set of overseas tours
yeah.
is going to be crucial, because I think if India falters on those overseas tours and doesn't come away with series wins, comfortable series wins, then they definitely don't deserve to be spoken of in the same breath.
When Virat Kohli was departing for Australia, as you were there at the BCCI headquarters, even I was there, he said that we know that our fast bowlers will take 20 wickets, something which you guys touched upon, that West Indies knew, Australia knew. So that is a similarity you would see from the previous eras?
The best teams have to thrive in all conditions. That's a given. So I think that what Virat mentioned, I remember that press conference, oh, we've got the bowlers to take 20 wickets. But I asked him a question there. I said, your batsmen are not making enough runs.
And which he agreed upon.
He agreed upon. Bowlers have been taking 20 wickets for the last 2.5-3 years. The optimism that Gaurav has mentioned and which I share completely is built on the bowlers' ability to take 20 wickets. In the past, Indian bowlers never could take 20 wickets overseas. And playing in India, three spinners would take 20 wickets all the time.
Any final thoughts, gentlemen, before I wrap it up?
I think we are very lucky to be covering Indian cricket at a time when, or looking at Indian cricket from a distance at a time when this group of players is coming together. And I think under a captain of the kind of ambition that he has for achieving the success that he wants to achieve at test level, it'll be great fun to watch this Indian team over the next few years.
So there you have it. Both gentlemen have weighed in on the prospect of India becoming a powerhouse. And obviously the overseas tests remain the last final frontier, as Steve Waugh put it. It's been a pleasure talking to you guys. That's all we have for you for this edition of First Post York. Thank you for joining us.